This episode is brought to you by State Farm. If you're a small business owner, you know that it isn't just your business, it's your life. And whatever your business might be, you want someone who understands. That's why you might want to check out State Farm Small Business Insurance. Why? Because State Farm agents are small business owners too, living and working in your community. That means they know what it takes to help you personalize your policies for your small business needs. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Talk to your local agent today. You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to help you plan that unbelievable travel experience. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Hi, I'm Kara Swisher, editor-at-large of Recode. You may know me as the only person to wear AirPods in a photo shoot for Vogue, but in my spare time, I talk tech, and you're listening to Recode Decode from the Vox Media Podcast Network. Today in the red chair is Hossein Rahman, the co-founder and former CEO of Jawbone, which is a wearable technology pioneer that started in 1999 and actually launched at our All Things D conference back then. We're going to talk about what happened there and his new project. Hossein, welcome to Recode Decode.
Thanks, Kara.
So we're going to have like a tough discussion and a not so tough discussion, but we're going to talk about what happened at Jawbone. So let's get people get way of a background of where you came from and what you created with Jawbone, because it really was a pioneer in the space. And then the same thing with speakers and things like that, which everyone copied really quickly. And so we really want to have a discussion here about what happens to entrepreneurs when they run into a buzzsaw, essentially, and then what you're doing now, which you're going to announce this week. Talk a little bit about your background, how you got to where you got.
Yeah, so I was at Stanford, mid-90s, and it was an incredible time, right? Larry and Sergey were there, mm-hmm. formation of Google. Before I got there, David and Jerry had started Yahoo. So it was this incredible explosion of creativity. Everybody was encouraged in the engineering school to go try their ideas. And so out of that environment, we came out in sort of 1999, and the original vision for the company was we were trying to build a speech recognition overlay on top of mobile devices. Mm-hmm. And as we started to build that, we realized so much of what we wanted to do.
So explain a speech recognition overlay.
Siri. It was effectively like Siri on top of like a Palm device or mm-hmm. a Nokia phone. We were really fascinated by mobile. We thought, wow, wouldn't it be neat if you could interact using your voice? Mm-hmm. It's funny now, you know, flash forward 18, 20 years later, voice is finally a thing and people are doing that. So we thought about this back in the kind of late 90s. And as we started to build that, we realized that there were so many limitations around what you could do with speech recognition. And we thought that we ended up inventing this noise cancellation technology, which removed all the background noise from a mobile phone call. Mm-hmm. And the idea was to improve the signal so that it would make speech recognition work. And when we invented that, turned out that was the biggest—
Because let's remember, at the time, these phones weren't very good.
They weren't very good.
Right, and this is pre-iPhone.
This is, I mean, come on, 1999. Yeah. It was way pre-iPhone.
It was 2004, right?
Seven.
Seven, right,
yeah.
Okay, yeah.
Anyway, so this was very early. People actually still talked a lot on their phones. Mm-hmm. And so mobile audio quality mattered a lot. And so we shifted from trying to make speech recognition work to just kind of building this fundamental layer for audio quality. That was now sort of called circa 2000, 2001. Things were tough in the technology market because you'd had the sort of first internet crash.
Right.
We ended up teaming up with DARPA to refine the science and the technology behind what we were doing.
They wanted the noise canceling.
The noise canceling stuff. We mm-hmm. refined that. And then kind of in 2002, we decided to build our own consumer product utilizing mm-hmm. the technology. And we decided to do that in a headset. And so that was kind of the inception, if you will, of the first sort of smart
headset.
Now, the smart headset.
So this was the idea that this had a wire to it because you debuted it at All Things D.
That was the first one that
yeah.
we debuted.
It had a long wire down to a pack on your...
Onto the body. And this was kind of pre-Bluetooth, right?
Right.
And so it was a bit of a kludgy physical implementation, but the technology performance.
So you had a thing that went in one ear, and then it had a long wire, if I remember.
Long
and
wire that clipped on your belt, and then there was a box there with a bunch of processing, and then it connected to your phone.
Right. So it was
and
a
that
long
we launched
version.
At the D conference. I think it was the second D conference
in
2004.
Right, and we put a lawnmower behind
weed
it.
Weed whacker
for noise canceling.
Turned it on and off, and it was an amazing
but
demo.
You, how many of those did you sell? You didn't sell, I think.
We didn't sell a lot. So the company almost died at that point. That was in 2004.
And what was the price point of that one?
Gosh, I think it was like $150.
Yeah.
And so it was pre-Bluetooth. So in 2005, we went down to four people, and we focused on, you know, making that technology and that product Bluetooth. Mm-hmm. And so call it in the end of 2006, we launched the first Bluetooth Jawbone. And you and Walt talked about it, and that one really took off.
Right.
Because now at
this
point,
was a device that went on your ear.
It went on your ear, was wireless, had all that same functionality.
But it was big. It was a big. It was big-ish.
It was as big as it needed to be to satisfy the state of the computing power,
right?
You know, sort of the chip size, battery, all that. Mm-hmm. So we launched that, and it took off. You know, we went from like $0 to $100 million run rate of revenue in the first year, and it was a wild ride. We were trying to hold on for dear life. Mm-hmm. And after that, we continue to scale that and make it smaller. And then when the iPhone launched in 2007, we were one of the, you know, third-party headsets that Apple sold alongside it in their stores, had great success from that. Also, there was all this hands-free legislation that came out that really drove that business. And then in the fall of 2008, when you had the big economic collapse, we were caught up alongside that where, you know, a bunch of orders we had from the channels and whatnot kind of disappeared.
All right. And also, everybody copied you. Correct?
I mean, that's the thing that happens in hardware, right?
Right.
Is you end up establishing a category, either the incumbents or a lot of manufacturers in China. Everyone sees that there's demand, and they all rush to sort of do a copycat. So we were effectively the first smart headset. And then another thing happened, which is the market moved from 1 year to 2 years. As your iPhone actually started to develop a bunch of media capability and all your music was there, your video, people wanted 2 years. And that was sort of where you got, you know, companies like Beats and all of that. And, you know, what we did at that same time is we invented the sort of first wireless speakers for your mobile phone devices. And
right,
that was the Jambox. And that was in 2010. So when we came out with the Jambox, the market for wireless speakers in the overall speaker market was 0%. And everyone thought we were crazy to do this very high quality portable mobile speaker that was wireless for your phone. But the thought was, you've got all this rich media in that device. How do you unlock it without having to dock it, take it with you everywhere, and turn the speaker into a computer? And that was sort of the first smart wireless speaker. So that debuted in 2010, and people loved it. It went crazy. And now I think the wireless speaker market of all speakers is like, you know, in the 99%. So in some ways, that product was kind of the godfather to everything that you see from, you know, Alexa or or the Echo, et cetera.
And it was
all
good looking.
Down.
We'll talk about design in a minute.
It was good looking.
So you jumped to that because the wireless earphone market changed. So that business dropped out.
Yeah, it sort of flatlined, right? And so for the next stage of growth, we went and created this new category of wireless speakers. And it's fun for us to see what's happened to that with all the innovation in the home. You got products like Google Home, Amazon Echo with the Alexa. It sort of evolved into media device meets, you know, voice interface for the home, and that's awesome. At the same time, in parallel, one of the things we were working on internally starting in 2009 is a lot of the sensors that we used in the headsets to measure when you were talking, actually, if you move them around the body, you could see other things about people's physiology and understand them. And so I felt like, hey, this would be a really interesting opportunity to open up this whole new understanding about what's going on with ourselves on sort of a continuous daily basis. So we worked on that for a couple of years. And then in 2011, we debuted the whole wrist wearables category. So it was the first time we did that, did it on stage at TED, got a bunch of wonderful feedback. People were really excited about this.
And
could
this was called?
This was called Up.
Up, right.
And so we debuted it in, you know, kind of mid-2011, talked about it publicly for the first time, and then we shipped the products in 11. They sold like crazy.
And had some glitches.
First of all, it just like went crazy. Like
It
was faster selling than anything we'd ever had. People were really excited about it. But we started to get reports from the field that they were breaking. And we couldn't get them back fast enough to figure out what was happening. And finally, when we did, we realized that what was happening is water was getting into the device, whether it's sweat or, you know, just wash your hands, whatever. Just when you wear something, it gets wet, right, whether you think it does or not. And that was getting into the device and shorting out some of the capacitors. So when we figured that out, we pulled it off the market. We went and did this big thing, apologized to all our customers, gave them refunds, let them keep using it. And people liked the way that we treated that whole situation, the way we handled it. So we went back to the drawing board in 2012, fixed all those waterproofing issues, and relaunched it at the end of 2012. And it went vertical again from a demand perspective. Then we ended up hitting a different problem, which is one of the things that, that plagues hardware startups when you get to a certain scale, is that we had a working capital issue where we had all these millions of units on order from our channel partners. We had a manufacturing base that needed to build up the supply chain, buy all the components, tooling, all that sort of stuff, build out that production capacity to supply it. But you need cash to do that, and it is extremely costly, and you've got to front load a lot of that cash. And given you're a startup, no manufacturer really wants to give you big credit or anything like that. So we scrambled in early 2013 to figure out how do we get this working capital cycle figured out, and we did a big debt deal with Fortress and Silver Lake, J.P. Morgan, and Wells Fargo, and that was, you know, part mezz debt as well as, you know, asset-based lending facility. And it's something that, you know, a lot of technology companies don't traditionally do that much because, you know, there aren't that many hardware startups.
So you needed the cash.
We needed the cash, and that's one of the things that happens with a hardware company is you've got to, like, if you have a successful product, you hit another wall, which is how do you fund all that growth efficiently, and equity is not the great way to do it. So the thought then was, in 2013, was let's do this big debt round. We'll pull the whole thing together. It'll get momentum back in. Yes, we had great momentum, and we're back ordered, but we actually needed to fulfill it, get the revenue machine going, and then we would go, you know, pay that debt off. So
you're like a wrist Tesla, but go ahead. A risk version.
I feel for a lot of the scaling issues they have. I mean, obviously, it's on a much smaller scale and smaller product, but it's not that dissimilar in terms of, like, the fundamental issues that you face, right? And you're doing new things, so there's new manufacturing processes, and you want to ensure quality. It's complicated. So anyway, so we're doing all that. That's 13. And the idea was we'd get the momentum back through the sort of working capital injection. And then at the end of that, we would do an equity raise, which would, you know, kind of pay off some of the debt and then, you know, create the next wave, and we'd, you know, sail off and do our thing. So at the end of 2013, beginning 2014, we ended up doing a deal, and we had two deals on the table. And this was an interesting lesson, candidly, for all entrepreneurs. And this is where one of the big mistakes that we made as an organization, me, you know, as sort of running the company, is we had two offers on the table. One was that call it, you know, $2 billion-ish. And then we had another one that was like, you know, $3.2 to $3.5 billion, in depending on how you sort of looked at how the deal was structured. So obviously a big delta. And we had a big split in the organization at the board level, shareholder level. Some of the folks that had come into the last round obviously wanted us to take the larger markup. And, you know, earlier folks were saying, hey, you know, we might not be ready. We're not stable enough to take such a high valuation, et cetera. Ultimately, we ended up taking the larger valuation. That deal, for a variety of reasons, didn't work, and it broke apart. So we
who was the big funder there?
The lead on the financing was Rizvi Traverse.
Right.
And so, again, for a variety of reasons, like, the financing broke. We never actually completed it. And that put us into a tailspin, right, in 2014, because we had a capital-intensive business. You know, with all these things, there's maybe 1,000 reasons, and ultimately none.
Give me two, Jose.
So look, there's so many things that went wrong. One of the things was that the capital that we were expecting to get didn't all show up.
Right. They were giving it to you in pieces, correct?
It wasn't that they were giving it to us in pieces. There was a sort of a syndication model. Mm-hmm. And I think there was misunderstanding on how the timing and how that all process would work. And I think there was just, you know, again, it happened in the past. And it's one of the things at the time we were all very frustrated. And I think there was a lot of anger on all sides of the equation. But it broke. It didn't happen. The syndicate didn't come together the way it anticipated at the time that it was expected to be. The company felt like it wasn't the company's fault, of course, right? And so it wasn't, the capital wasn't all there in the way that the deal had been signed up to do. So then all of a sudden, now we found ourselves in a scramble, and effectively you're trying to sort of duct tape and baleen wire this thing up. And so I talked to a lot of entrepreneurs now about be really careful how you structure these deals, the capital you take in, what you agree to, and is the business ready for it, right? Because when you raise money at those kinds of prices, it's really hard to move and recover and sort of be nimble. You've got a big scale organization. Just things get really, really complicated. So what ended up happening is when that financing broke, we all, the management team, had to go out of the building to go raise capital and try to hold things together. And that's when you started, you know, a lot of things started to crack. Like, if we're not in the building, there's not direction. You know, our product execution suffered. Our in-market execution suffered. obviously, a lot of our competitors surged at the time and started to catch us in the various markets in terms of market share.
Fitbit and others.
Fitbit and others, even in the speaker space. I mean, you know, so we in a lot of these spaces, we had, you know, 80% market share. But as these things evolved, like, people start to chip away from you. And then the other thing that happened to us in early 15 is that we realized that six of our ex-employees had stolen, you know, sort of systematically stolen 365,000 documents, which was basically all of our trade secret information, and gone to Fitbit. So then we got into this, like, very expensive legal battle to protect ourselves. Since then, actually, the DOJ just a couple months ago criminally charged all six of those people for that. So sort of, you know, ultimately showed why we had to protect ourselves, because there was pretty massive criminal activity around that. So that was happening at the same time. And then what ended up happening is, in order to sort of salvage ourselves from that situation, we had to do a bunch of structures, ultimately including a bunch of debt structures that the company, frankly, just wasn't tooled to.
So you're desperate for money.
Yeah, I mean, you're trying to hold it together. There's all this cool promise of the technology. You see that there's demand. One of the things that we've always been really good at Jawbone was inventing new stuff, right? Creating new technologies, creating new product categories. I mean, we did it three times, right? We did the smart headset devices. A number of the people on the Jawbone headset team have ended up working on AirPod, which is awesome. Really proud of the work that they're doing there. A number of our speaker folks ended up at, you know, Amazon and other places working on products that are now rolling out and getting scale. So we see that. And, you know, obviously we created the wrist-based wearables market. We were the first ones there well before Fitbit or Nike, and then ultimately before any of the smartwatches. So, you know, we saw these things early. And so we had continued to develop really cool technology that we felt like was going to take this thing to the next level.
But not taking advantage of it. It strikes me as...
Well, I think the thing that's hard in a hardware business model, candidly, is you don't necessarily generate enough gross margin to fund R&D and marketing, right? And that's what makes it really hard to get to an escape velocity. So if you think about hardware, anybody, like, the two companies that really make money in hardware are Apple and Samsung, right? And if you think about the startups... What startup has achieved total escape velocity and continued to scale? You look at guys like Ring, they sell out, they get great success, you know, get out a billion, same with Nest, Tony got out at three. It's awesome. They get to a certain scale and they, you know, say, look, to get to the next level, we need bigger partners and bigger backers to kind of fund that expansion. And if you look at companies like Fitbit or GoPro, they do put a lot of what they get in margin into marketing, and they build brands, and, you know, they're spending $100 million a quarter for TV advertising.
But one's
and all
doing
stuff.
Better than the other. Obviously, GoPro has been in distress for a while.
You know, Fitbit has its challenges,
yes,
right?
It
trades at a fraction of its, I think, revenue multiple, right?
So,
but the point is like, but they didn't make all the R&D investments. Mm-hmm. And so what we were doing is putting a lot of our capital into R&D investments and funding inventory and trying to scale, not so much on marketing, right? And so—
And you're running around persistently looking for funding.
And it's a tough way to live, right?
Well, it's also you're always selling. You're like a bit of a P.T. Barnum in that. Like, it's going to work. It's going to work. We have these great ideas.
Yeah, and you know, we believed it.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't
say you didn't believe it. I'm saying but you're constantly hawking the future, essentially, this time.
When you're raising capital?
In general, yeah, when you're doing this, because you're going from one to the other and losing the previous business. You know, here you started with the earphones, and then people caught up. Cost too much. These things do have a cycle, by the way, all these products.
Absolutely. Right?
Then you move to the next one, which is the speakers, and then that gets eaten up, and then you move to the next one. It strikes me as the planes are covered with the bodies of pioneers. You know what I mean? Like, the concept of that people, like, and that's what happened. And then you end up sort of trying desperately to keep the funding going at the same time.
To sort of, you know, go to the next stage of it, because there's that inception of the market.
And then it creates bad will all over the place. I mean, so we're going to talk about those errors when we get back. But one of the things that I'd really like to get into is sort of this journey of the entrepreneur, because more than any, you know, we talked about this, the emails I get about Jawbone are really, you've got some people who hate you, for example, and you have some debts behind, and what do you do with the investors? So I want to talk about that, because I think you want to be honest about what happens with these things, because on one hand, you have these incredible pioneering concepts that everybody else takes advantage of. You're not Echo, you know, you started that.
Yeah.
You're not Beats, you started that. You're not
the Apple Watch.
The Apple Watch, right?
Yeah.
So planes are covered with the bodies of pioneers. So I want to talk about what mistakes you think you made along the way so entrepreneurs can get an idea of what it was and what you regret doing, and then what you think you did well, which would be great when we get back.
Okay.
We're here with Hossein Rahman. He is the is it Jawbone still or
Jawbone Health?
We're going to talk about your new. There's Jawbone a new Health. Thing where I promise I'm going to get to talk to your newest thing when we get back after we take a quick break.
This episode is brought to you by State Farm. You've heard it before. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. But it's more than just a tagline. Because State Farm agents are small business owners themselves who live and work in your community. And if you're in the market for small business insurance, who better to work with than an agent who understands what it takes? State Farm agents can help you create a personalized insurance plan that fits your small business needs and budget. Talk to your local State Farm agent today about small business insurance. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Vacations can be tricky. You already know how to book flights and hotels, but now the only thing you're missing is, you know, the actual travel experience. Because is it really a vacation if you're just sitting around like you would at home? You need a tool to get the most out of your time away. That's where Viator steps in. You can book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected. And 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
We're here with Hossein Rahman. He is the co-founder of Jawbone, which was a groundbreaking hardware company in Silicon Valley. There's not very many hardware companies in Silicon Valley. There's very few, and most of them hit the rocks.
Yeah.
And you've hit a lot of rocks. So let's talk about those.
Yes.
So you talked about this idea of creating all these amazing things, and you really did. You kept coming up with something. You were heavy in design. You made things very beautiful. It was very Apple-esque in a lot of ways, even more so, more stylish, more colorful. The earphones were beautiful. The Fitbits kept changing to look like – remember one time you said they're going to look like jewelry?
Yeah.
You were trying to add features onto all of them. You had a deal with – was it Amex at one point?
We had a deal with Amex.
Yeah, you were trying –
We were doing wearable payments. Yeah.
Right, wearable payments.
Early.
You know, very early. And first – I think you're the first one I heard talking about
We
this
were the
concept.
First people to do it.
Yeah.
And, you know, there was issues there. There weren't terminals ready to accept the payments. They weren't – enough places. It was sort of new
behavior.
Right,
but you were talking about it before that was.
We saw it.
You saw it.
We saw it early.
Right, exactly. Yeah. So, but along the way, you raised how much total?
A little bit over north of $1 billion.
$1 billion.
Yeah.
Where did that
And a lot of that came after 2011.
Okay, with all those different debt financings.
Shareholders. Some of the growth investors at that point, that's when we started
to raise. Some of the biggest investors in Silicon Valley, too.
Yes, those guys came in earlier than that where we didn't raise huge amounts of money really until 2011.
Right. And then you had a stellar board. You had Marissa Mayer, ex-Yahoo CEO.
Yes.
You had Ben, I'm losing my mind.
Ben Horowitz.
Ben Horowitz from Andreessen Horowitz.
Yes.
You had Yves Bihar, is that correct?
Was he wasn't on the board.
He designed it.
He was our creative partner.
Yeah. And who else was on the board there?
Vinod Khosla.
Vinod Khosla. Lots of
you had all. Bota.
Yeah, you had everybody pretty much.
Yeah.
So you're raising all this money. I sound like an idiot, but where did the $1 billion go?
Well, so a lot of it came after 2011.
Right.
And that's when the business was scaling. And you know, we never shared our revenue numbers, but we were doing, you know, several hundred million dollars at a time. I think at our peak, we got to almost like a $500-600 million of revenue to us, right? Mm-hmm. $500-600 million run rate, you know, sort of to Jawbone, which means that we produce billions of dollars in revenue for our channel partners like Best Buy and Apple and Amazon and all carriers and all those guys. So, you know, the franchises were successful from a revenue perspective to our partners.
Mm-hmm.
As I said, I think that the challenge with hardware for us is like we put all that design content into it. We put all of that new technology into it. And it's hard as a hardware startup. You don't generate enough margin to really – like, you know, somebody told me the other day Apple spent like $900 billion on tooling for the Apple Watch.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, $900 million, not $900 billion.
That's what I was thinking.
That was
like,
a lot.
No, everybody should have one on their wrist if they have that much money.
Even $900 million is a lot for tooling, I can tell you. Mm-hmm. As someone who's built a lot of devices, I mean, we shipped about 40 million-ish devices over time in the different categories, so a good amount. Mm-hmm. But you know, the challenge is like, how do you, as a startup, like build for that kind of scale, the automation, the supply chain efficiencies you get,
et cetera. And then you have glitches and things like that.
And you get glitches. You don't have, like, room for error to sort of, you know, go fix that stuff. So, you know, what takes up a lot of the cash is the working capital cycle. You're trying to scale R&D, right, because you've got to build the next thing. And in all these things, you're only as good as your next device or your next product. And, you know, look, as we evolved and as the devices got smarter – and as they became more connected, we added a lot more software content to it. Mm-hmm. Like in the early days, a lot of our software team was, you know, machine learning algorithms, digital signal processing. And then as it sort of evolved, we moved up the software stack. And with the Up device, we had a full-blown application. Mm-hmm. You know, it was the most engaging application.
Yeah, you were trying to get people in to answer questions, compete. You tried gaming.
It all, I mean, it was great. I mean, it had 10x the engagement, still does, of anybody in the digital health space, right? And so I think it's that between Facebook and Snapchat in terms of daily engagement.
Right. So it people would give you messages.
And it changed behavior, and we're building off a lot of the stuff we learned from that. But, you know, so we did a lot of that, and that software and services create more stickiness and more community, and there's a bunch of data that you can use to, you know, how to help people. And that's a lot of the foundation for what we're doing now. But again, it gets back to the fact that you just don't generate enough margin to do all of that heavy future R&D.
Right.
And that doesn't—R&D doesn't work on a linear basis. Like, that process of creating new stuff is
absolutely
not linear,
and
right?
You were—one of the things, you were always trying new things. You would call me with lots of new things, and I kept thinking, oh, my God, when is this guy going to stop? Like, it's not—it's not—it's like jumping from lily pad to lily pad, it felt like. But let's talk about the problems of that. You obviously— Where did the $1 billion? Let's start with the money. Where did the money go?
So look, a lot of it went to fund the R&D and the creation of new technology. A lot of it went to working capital to fund inventory and that scaling. And a lot of it went to, you know, whatever was left. We funded the operation and people as well as and again, we weren't able to generate enough margin. And there was lots of arguments at a board level, which is, are we putting too much energy into the design side? Are we putting too much dollar investment? Or are unit economics so expensive that we can't charge enough to justify that, right? The Apple model is, let's put a bunch of really cool technology into it and, you know, high design, but we're going to charge a real premium. Mm-hmm. And they're able to do that at scale, right? And we weren't able to necessarily charge the premiums that justified all of the COGS, that the cost of goods sold that we put into the device. And so that's the downside, frankly, of being a high design product.
So why take all that money if you knew this, you know, this wasn't going to work?
Well, at the time you didn't, I mean, look, we didn't take money thinking it wasn't going to
work.
No,
I get that. I
mean,
that.
We created the smart headset space.
Right.
We thought that was going to continue. It's very hard to predict when these things flatline, as you know. Mm-hmm. And then do you have the
R&D? Except
that
they always flatline.
They always do. At some point, they ask them to, right?
Right.
You know, one of the things people don't talk about enough is Apple did the iPhone as a transition from iPod. And it was probably one of the most masterful product transitions when they were at the peak of the market. Everyone's like, wow, they're just sort of dumping that off. We watched the other side of that, which was the Motorola Razr, where I think they did 21 versions of that same phone, right?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Just trying to, you know, sort of ride the wave. And so a lot of that is a timing issue, you know, cannibalizing yourself, deciding you have the new thing, it's ready to go, and kind of scaling to the next level. And I would say that we did it for a couple generations, but what we didn't do well was continue to harness and continue to bring the new thing and the new thing and the new thing. And candidly, it's really hard to do that across three different categories at the same time within a startup. The capital it takes, the amount of people, the talent to forward front all of that is really, really expensive.
So why would go ahead, keep going.
So I think that's a big part of the challenge. I was talking to Mary Mika the other day, who's you know, was an investor in the first Jawbone, and she said, you know, I wonder what would have happened had we sort of thought about selling off those businesses at their peaks.
Yeah, why didn't you?
Well, it's hard to predict when peak is.
Well, I know, but, you know, there is a peak.
But by the time you see it,
it's
starting to be descending,
right?
And there's a variety of factors. In some ways, you know, the thing that got us through when we had to take the Up was our speaker business.
Mm-hmm.
When we had to take the Up off market, you know, we stayed alive because we had the speaker business.
So why didn't you sell? I'm suspecting you had a number of chances to do so at some point because it was very hot for a long time.
You know, look, it wasn't just a me decision.
Right.
I think that there was opportunities where we had opportunities to exit the business. I think that, you know, you look at all the factors, you look at where you stand, you look at what you have in the pipe, and you make that decision the best you can with your board to say, can we take it to the next level? Do we have the resources?
And you kept thinking you could.
You know, we're believers. You're right. Entrepreneurs.
You, except you keep getting kicked in the head with each product, like at some point.
But at some point, you get credit for perseverance, right?
Not usually, but okay. Yeah, no, but I mean, I want you to get to
But isn't that what the value's built on?
Right, but most people who have done better have sold. It seems like. I'm thinking of Instagram, lots of things. It could have, but by the way, he could have made Instagram enormous, Kevin Systrom, right? Who is investing in your newest thing. We'll talk about that in a minute. But
he has made it enormous.
Yes, he has made it enormous, but it's where someone else. What would he have done if it was by itself, for example? Or would he have gotten to that level? These are all the things that entrepreneurs go into. What prevented you from doing that? Because then the plane, like I said, the planes are covered with the bodies of pioneers, and you have something like, there's so many. The one that they just did the documentary about that became the iPhone.
The thing that Fidel did.
Exactly.
Yeah,
a long time ago. So talk about like
you mean what, became the iPod.
Eventually, a version of
Fuse. It was called.
No, not Fuse. It was called something else. Anyway, there's just tons of them, and I have them all in a drawer in my house. Why not sell? Like, talk about that journey of like you just think you're going to be the next big thing. I presume.
Yes. There's a part of that for sure. But you also see it and you see what you've been able to achieve. You see what's held you back. And, you know, part of being that pioneer and that creator is thinking that you can push through those walls, mm-hmm. right? I'll give you a great example. When we were doing wireless speakers, when we invented that space, there were a lot of people who told us that we were crazy to do it, mm-hmm. right? That, you know, going into the speaker space, there were so many dead bodies. Big brands, you know, a lot of channel pressure. It just wasn't like a great category.
Right.
But we did it and we transformed it, right? And I find that process of creating new things extremely rewarding. It's tough. There's a lot of fights and you're pushing and you're trying new things. There's no playbook established. But that process is, you know, if you're a creator, that's what you live for.
Right.
Right. And the opportunity to do it and for people to value what you bring to their lives. And like, look, I've had so many incredible experiences with the products that we've built and people loving them. Right. I had somebody come up to me at a party once that I'd never met who said, I feel like you were there for the birth of my child. Mm-hmm. And I was like, what do you mean? Mm-hmm. And they said, well, I had one job when my kid was born, which was to be in charge of the music. Uh-huh. Right. And I had a Jambox and we were late getting there and it was this extremely long labor. And having that Jambox there and playing the list of music that my wife wanted.
Well, that's the hope.
No, but like it was a touching thing,
right?
To sort of hear that played a role in this like significant moment
but,
in someone's lives.
In being creative and creating things, you also leave behind a lot of anger, like, right? I mean, you were aware of that. We've talked about it extensively. I used to get emails from employees. I think they were employees who were unhappy with you. I can't imagine investors weren't happy about losing that amount of money. And then, you know, you also had vendors and stuff like we talked about that, too.
Yeah.
That you didn't pay and stuff like that. But you're also in this creative mode. I want you to get to like a bigger idea of the entrepreneur when you're like this, when you're juggling. You're not paying this person. You have investors on your back. You know, you've made management mistakes. And I want to finish. I'll finish this part, I promise. But what things do you think you did wrong there? And what things did you do right?
How much time do we have?
No, we keep going.
No, I mean, like, no, I'm saying, like,
no,
this
I know
is
that,
like, we could do, like, a 10-day
right.
series
like,
on this.
When like, you don't, when you open
when
you,
when things don't
when
go
you,
well,
yes.
you spend every, there's not, like, a moment in my life where it goes, where I don't think about it every single night.
Right.
About all the mistakes we made and all the things that went wrong and what we would do differently.
For all people listening,
like, all of that, it's hard. Like, I mean, it can be emotionally and mentally crushing.
Right.
Right, it crushes your soul. Like,
but then
you
again,
put
you
every,
took the money, right? So you want to,
which is
do
why
it.
I stuck with it. Yeah. I had a lot of people who said, "Hey, you know what? Come do this. Like, here's this job, or here's this other opportunity. Jump into this. You want to help do this? Like," and I didn't walk away.
So why? I want to understand.
Because I took a bunch of other people's money,
right?
And until I thought it was going to die, they were going to have to carry me out in a body bag,
So
right? And that's the commitment
that
I made.
What would you have done differently?
I mean, again, do we have like a month?
I know. Give me two or three things.
Well, look, I think that a hardware business model is really hard.
Right.
And I think that we would have moved to services a lot faster, which is what we're doing in the new thing. Number one, I think we wouldn't have overreached on valuation, right? I think we would have been a lot more paced and disciplined.
Do you get caught up in that?
Or? Of course. Yeah. Of course. Like, you know, we were one of the first unicorns and everyone's like, oh, my God, you're great.
I remember,
And you can be this and you get all these accolades.
Like a plane. Yeah. That kind
of. I mean, come on. You know, it's hard. Like, there's nobody teaches you sort of how to be disciplined in these situations where everything's trying to sweep you off your feet. And so.
Overvaluation. Hardware.
Wrong structures.
What about management?
I mean, look, you come into these – one of the things like a firm like Andreessen Horowitz does and like what Ben's been amazing at is they help train a lot of these people because you don't get that training. There is nothing that you can go to school for that helps you be a great manager, right? But you need that training. You need that rigor. And a lot of it is by doing, right? And so do I think it – I'm 42 now. Do I think I'm way better – as a manager than I was when I was younger? Absolutely.
A lot of these companies are in the hands of people who aren't. You could look at Facebook. I think it's a management problem. He was not experienced. He has not been experienced. You don't have to say anything about Mark Zuckerberg, but I don't think that management team had a veneer of being highly competent because they did very well. But a lot of it was stuff they shouldn't be doing.
Well, look, hypergrowth hides a lot of problems.
That's what I mean, exactly.
And I've been through three or four hypergrowth cycles.
Yeah, exactly.
And so you don't end up taking the time to build a really, really good foundation.
Or a management structure.
Or a management structure. Like, look, I used to think HR was this thing that you just like applied later as you were scaling. In the new thing, we've had like HR partners right from the beginning, right? Building the infrastructure. Here's how we operate. Here's how we work. Here's our set of thinking. Here's what's okay. Here's what's not. Here's how we communicate. Here's how we catch problems early. Here's how we hold people accountable. I mean, these are all things that are important and just as important as the creation side. And frankly, you think when you're that it's all about the creation.
Right.
It's all about that new thing and everything's going to fix itself. Well, guess what? Like, it doesn't. And you have to do that. You have to invest in yourself. You have to grow. You have to manage your insecurities, your blind spots. You have to be really transparent and understanding about that. Like, I'm a big advocate of coaching and mentorship and talking about this stuff. I'm a lot more open about my strengths and weaknesses. I work on them. You know, mental health, people don't talk about enough, right? That stress is hard. And it's wonderful when everyone's saying good things and the level – and look, what you realize in these things is all the credit is sometimes overplaced and all of the blame is sometimes overplaced, both sides, right? And it's one of those things where you have to find that balance and like what makes you and what drives you and what are the things that give you confidence and what are the things that cause stress.
Well, one of the other things is you wrote a really positive press wave and then a negative one when the things broke down. That was the first time I remember when there were stories about, you know, the problem with the sweating, which I think every company goes through. Like Apple's gone through it 20 times. But with you, it mattered a great more because you were just a small company.
Right.
Right.
No, you go through the ups and downs, right?
So do you think you handle
Why do you think that is, by the way, the queen of Silicon Valley Press. Why is that? Why do they take it up and take it down? Why does that cycle have to be?
Because I think you all hype it too. Like, we're all great. We're all this. You know, I think what we don't do a good job of is monitoring it during the time. It's like, isn't Mark Zuckerberg a genius? I'll use him, not you necessarily. And then now it's clear there's some management problems there, right? There's some decision-making problems. There's some wisdom problems there that are clear. And I think when you start to say that, which I think I've been more than most people say they can't do that, people in Silicon Valley don't like it at all.
Don't like what?
Well, you know, when we were, you know, I was tough on your board member, Marissa Mayer. I didn't think she was up for the task of that job. I didn't think that Travis was, didn't hang the moon. And I think saying
But the it, way it goes is it's this, like, attack, and then the other side digs in, and it's not like, can you get help? What are the problems that
you need to solve? Yeah, but we're not your partners. But I agree with you. I think it's
No, no, I'm not saying that that's necessarily yourself. It's just, it becomes this, like, polarization.
Well, yeah,
right?
It's true, but part of it is your products were very exciting. Right? And at the same time, when you're hearing, like, he didn't pay this person, these investors are mad, maybe they're going to go out of business, you have to – it's hard to do a more – this is why I want to talk about this. It's a much more complex issue than it is. And so what you do is you leave behind a lot of people who are angry at you, and they're willing to talk about it. And had it gone – had you sold to Apple the way Beats did, you'd be a genius, right? right? Like, I'm just saying, that's the thing. If you had sold, nobody would be complaining, right?
Or look, you had... I like to look at everything that happened in a lot of detail to think about what to learn from it, what to do better. And I spend a lot of time now thinking about how can I take those lessons and how can other people learn from my mistakes? And what are the platforms and what
Give me, and then we're going to talk about what you're doing next, I promise, in the next section. What are your two biggest mistakes that you made?
I think we absolutely overreached on, you know, sort of valuations and picking the wrong partners and end up agreeing to structures that just weren't right for us. And I think we probably should have taken a step back, slowed down, rebuilt, built a solid foundation that was sort of better to scale from and gone slower. And I think there's a lot of pressure to move quickly, to grow faster. And I think that, you know, one of the things that happens is each business has its own dynamic, right? So consumer internet businesses scale really fast because you have platforms set up that, like, allow that to happen. Enterprise businesses scale differently. Healthcare businesses, completely different cycle. Pharma businesses, biotech, different cycle completely, right? Hardware, different cycle. So I think that there needs to be more rational discussions of, like, what are reasonable growth rates. But when you have an environment where some things are growing really, really fast, everybody gets caught up in that. And you're like, oh, no,
so
I need to be there too.
I think you all get licked up and down. And then it ends up in the worst way in a Theranos situation where there's actual fraud going on and a lot of hyping. But there, she's a version of everybody else. Do you know what I mean? Just taking it too far, taking it too far. I think she's a version too salesy. Too, everything's going to be fine. Too positive. Like, I hate to say that, but it's too positive.
It's like, it's a balance, right? Because you have to be extremely brutally honest when you look in the mirror and when you look at your organization.
But y'all aren't.
But I think everybody is in the dark.
Sure.
Or when they're by themselves.
Right.
Like, way more than people let on.
Right.
And then the balance is, and I don't know who's achieved this well. So, like, I don't feel like
necessarily
have either.
No, because the ones that are successful look good, right?
Well, again, success washes away a lot of sins.
Right, exactly.
And bad foundational elements, right? But I think that what you need is the ability to be optimistic, lead a charge, because that's what it takes to break new ground and do something new. If you weren't optimistic and just pessimistic, you'd never take these risks and these challenges, right? So you need that. But you also have to be really grounded in the realities of where you are. And that's a hard duplicity, right, of sort of going back and forth. And that, and it's hard to sort of move yourself back
and
forth.
I get that. The only issue I have with most Silicon Valley people is they took the money. So stop. Like, you took the money and therefore you have the responsibility.
Yeah, and you have the responsibility. So you stick with it till it –
Right, exactly.
Through the trenches, right?
We're going to talk about what you're doing next. Thank you for answering this question, Hussein. I appreciate it. But I do want to talk about this because I think people –
I think it's important. I mean, look, we're unpacking a lot of beyond what happened at Jawbone stuff that I think could be interesting lessons because that's what I hope for now.
Right. And also the forgiveness zone and who gets forgiven and who doesn't. And we're going to talk about
Let's talk about that.
Because you have been forgiven. You've got
Sort of. I hope. Right?
I'm not God, so I won't say anything. Anyway,
I don't know that you've forgiven me yet.
I've never forgiven any of you people. We're going to take a quick break now. We'll be back in a minute with Hossein Rahman. We're talking about his company, Jawbone. And we're talking about Jawbone Health, which has been a phoenix from the ashes. Is that how we refer to it?
Well, I think that's the hope.
That's the hope. All right.
Support for this show comes from Slack. You're a growing business, and you can't afford to slow down. If anything, you could probably use a few more hours in the day. That's why the most successful growing businesses are working together in Slack. Slack is where work happens, with all your people, data, and information in one AI-powered place. Start a call instantly in huddles and ditch cumbersome calendar invites. Or build an automation with Workflow Builder to take routine tasks off your plate. No coding required. Grow your business in Slack. Visit slack.com to get started.
This episode is brought to you by Choiceology, an original podcast from Charles Schwab. Choiceology is a show all about the psychology and economics behind our decisions. Each episode shares the latest research in behavioral science and dives into themes like, can we learn to make smarter decisions? And the power of do-overs. The show is hosted by Katie Milkman. She's an award-winning behavioral scientist, professor at the Wharton School, and author of the best-selling book, How to Change. In each episode, Katie talks to authors, historians, athletes, Nobel laureates, and everyday people about why we make irrational choices and how we can make better ones to avoid costly mistakes. Listen and subscribe at schwab.com/podcast or find it wherever you listen.
We're here with Hossein Rahman. We're talking about what happened at Jawbone, which had raised $1 billion, put out a lot of great products, but had a lot of problems. But now he has a new company called Jawbone Health. And you said Phoenix. I was saying Phoenix from the ashes, but $1 billion of ashes. So what have you done now? You closed Jawbone.
Yeah. So
you said sorry.
No. What happened was
$1 billion.
So we ended up in 2015 doing a big debt deal that ultimately the structure of it just made it hard, and we didn't have flexibility to sort of shift a new direction. And in 2015, we also realized a lot of the sort of consumer fitness stuff was flatlining, and that wasn't really where the future of wearables was going to go. We had a number of breakthroughs on the technology sensing side. We started to get into deeper clinical measures around vitals and, like, understanding more of what was going on with people. We had bought a few things, hired a chief medical officer, and just sort of expanded.
Yeah, is this the same management? Or you went through a lot of different people. Like, you seem to have a CFO every 5 minutes. But is this the same team, or is it a different team?
At Jawbone Health?
Yeah.
There's about 110 people that came over from the old company.
And how many were at the old company?
At peak, I think it got to close to 600.
Wow.
So yeah. That process of going up and down is hard to.
I can imagine.
Another podcast.
Yeah.
But so the new company, what ended up happening is we had this big debt structure. We tried a number of different business plans and different initiatives, and it was a lot of back and forth.
What was your last one? I can't remember. What was the last one you did that you were trying different things?
A lot of what we were doing in 16 we never talked about.
Right.
And then, so it was, but it was all, we turned off all of our retail stuff and said, you know, we want to focus on this deeper health stuff. Stop making devices. Turned off all of our sales in early 16, and we said, we're going to go focus on this deeper
clinical health. Were the sales off? Health. These were off. They just flat
I mean, we were still selling.
Right.
Like, there was a lot of revenue, but it wasn't profitable, and it wasn't yielding the future, right? So we said, instead of focusing on that and going to fight that, takes a lot of time, takes more capital, all those things. We said, let's go. We've got this really interesting stuff. Everyone that sees it is blown away by
and
what
patents.
We're doing. 2,800, right? We have a huge sort of intellectual property war chest at the time. And so the thought was, let's go figure out what it looks like in this deeper health care arena and what, if anything, we can do. And we learned a lot. I mean, it was a crazy journey in 16, and we tried different paths, and ultimately none of them worked because we couldn't just get out from underneath this kind of structure that we had, this sort of debt structure. And there was a group in the Middle East called Maras, which is a Dubai-based group. It's sort of one of the largest investment groups there.
So you traveled all the way to the Middle East to get money.
We met them.
They do have a lot of money. They seem to be spreading it around SoftBank.
I mean, look, the Middle East investors, the sovereigns, and a lot of these folks are the capital behind the capital,
right?
And have been since the, like, late 70s. And I think it's just something that people don't realize. Like, they're large LPs in all of the big financial institutions in New York.
But they've shown up more visibly, I think.
Yeah, and I think that they're thinking about
SoftBank,
and I think they're doing great stuff. And I think they realize, like, look, we can deploy this capital directly into innovative businesses and push the envelope and market make and sort of be a lab to showcase what's possible and bring that to the rest of the world. I actually think it's exciting, and I think that it's frankly a cool alternative narrative for the Middle East versus a lot of what gets out in the other domains around, you know, frankly, like terrorists and, you know, political instability and all that stuff. I think deploying capital to further innovation is an awesome part of what they do.
The jig is up in oil at some point, so they need to move.
They
it
need
into
to diversify for sure. But I think that, look, they have a vision for the future, and I think they're willing to invest, and they have been long term investors in a lot of stuff and things that you'd be surprised to know that they were big massive backers and owners of and have been for decades, right? And we had some of those folks in the old Jawbone, and they had introduced us to this group in Dubai, Maras, and they came and saw what we had built, and they were really blown away by a lot of the clinical-grade technology that we were working on. They said, look, if you had kind of a fresh start and, you know, ability to launch into new markets, like, what would you build? And we said, wow, that's a really cool opportunity. Here's sort of what we'd build. And they said, that's neat. We want to set up a new company, Jawbone Health, and you know, we'll back that and we'll buy out the assets. Mm-hmm. So that's what ended up happening. And then they hired us in to do that.
So that was buy out the assets. What is that? I mean, this was
so they went to
you had this massive valuation.
They went to the debtors. Well, at that point, the company's in the hands of the creditors.
And the shareholders
right?
are zeroed out.
The shareholders are sitting underneath all of that,
right?
And this is the kind of tough structures. There's mm-hmm. not flexibility to do stuff.
Right.
But anyways, they went to those people, and it was like an arm's length transaction. They said, we formed a new company. We want to buy out all the health stuff. You guys can go sell the audio pieces off. But we want to take this thing into a deeper thing, Jawbone Health. And they hired, you know, me and a bunch of the team that we brought over to go do that. So we formed that company in January 2017. And we've been heads down focused on building this new service, which we're going to talk about publicly, the total picture of it. For the first time, you know, this week. Mm-hmm. And, you know,
so you're taking the services that you probably should have invested in before and doing a health. Explain what you're doing.
Yeah. So what Jawbone Health is building is this personalized subscription service where we take all this continuous health data about you and we combine that with a lot of machine intelligence, so AI, plus human doctors. They go analyze all this data. And the idea is to catch issues going on with you, health issues. Particularly in the lifestyle disease, preventive health, to catch them early when they can be treated and you can improve longevity. Because the problem is like, look, 2/3 of all deaths today are lifestyle disease related, which means it's just bad living, right? But the reality is if you catch that stuff early and you change your behavior or whatnot, you can push out half of those deaths and save 70% of the cost. The problem is we have no information. We don't know where we stand, what's going on with us, right? We have 500,000 minutes a year in our lives. Mm-hmm. If you're good, you spend 15 minutes a year with a doctor, maybe 4 times a year. That's like a very small percentage of the population. So the idea is to give people tools. And what we realized through the wearables journey is you had to elevate the actual sensor technology to a clinical grade level. What does that mean? It means you have to take it through an IRB process of doing clinical trials, which is an institutional review board approved by the NIH. Everybody, you know, the big institutions like Mayo and Stanford.
And you're going to be publishing these studies.
We already started to. So mm-hmm. a few weeks ago, we published at the Deep Learning Conference, the KDD conference in London. We published a lot of our deep learning stuff around atrial fibrillation, for example. It's the thing that Apple announced. We've got fantastic results there, 4 9s on positive predictive value, which means that we're 99% accurate at predicting that. That's something we did at UCSF. That has been accepted as in the American Heart Association, so we're going to publish there. So it's a very different model where you do this stuff, you publish it, third parties. And the idea of the clinical trials is you have third parties running this data, you correlate it to ground truth against known standards like FDA or other, you know, certification bodies. And then you go correlate all of that, and it's then proven out clinically, empirically, in published data that it works. You take all that information. So now you know you have really accurate stuff, and you go run a bunch of machine intelligence mm-hmm. on that. And then you have humans look at that
right.
and make determinations.
You're trying to, right. And then it goes to your doctor and insurance company? The privacy implications, obviously.
So the whole thing is an encapsulated service where we grab the data off. We analyze it. You have a doctor in the system that analyzes it.
There's a whole bunch of startups that are trying.
There's people doing different pieces.
No one's
pulled the whole thing together.
Right.
And we're looking at a series of different lifestyle diseases. We have the continuous monitoring piece.
Which is a device. You're going to be having another device, right?
But the device is free with the service. So
right.
it's not like a hardware business
model.
It's a
monthly
subscription
model.
You
will have a device of your own. Will you build into other devices?
We have a device on our own. We did that because we needed to show what was possible.
Mm-hmm.
The plan is to let other people build
like
on
Apple
our sensor
people.
Technology.
Well, they're doing their own thing.
Well, we're actually going to integrate Apple Watches because now that they've gone to a clinical grade level, we can use that information.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll never build a smartwatch, for example, right? That's Apple's doing a great job of that. So, you know, our device is to showcase what's possible. And the idea is to let other people build on our sensor technology because we've proven that it's clinical grade.
But you will have a device once again, but you'll give it away.
We're giving it away. And right. then ultimately there'll be other people's devices.
Right. So this group in Dubai bought out the investors.
They bought the assets in the health domain
of the old
Jawbone.
Which is not unlike, say, Slack was a game company that lost all kinds of money and then they pulled Slack out of it.
I don't know what Slack restructuring was.
Yeah. But so it's a restructuring. So the shareholders in the old Jawbone, gone.
So what ended up happening when the new company was created, mm-hmm. ultimately there was no plan for the old company. So they sold off the audio assets. I think whatever proceeds went to the debtors. And then they shut that down.
Right. So zero.
No, they got some stuff. There was a litigation with Fitbit and a bunch of those other things that were assets in the old company, and then that all got sold off. It wasn't a return of capital to the debtors, and it didn't cross the debt so that shareholders got paid back.
Yeah.
And then, you know, we've been focused on—
And you've created— you have new investors. Are the old investors still investing with you?
Some. Some have gotten back
in. And then you've got a bunch of angel investors, correct?
So you've primarily it's been funded by this Dubai organization,
Maras. And this is how much did you raise?
We haven't been saying.
Okay.
But it's enough to, you know, fund the operation, get us to clinical trials, and get going. And
tens of millions of dollars, I understand. You don't have to answer. Anyway, it's tens of millions of dollars. All right. But it's to get the
service.
And
then alongside Dubai, a number of folks came in as well.
Right. And it's also
some of our old investors.
You're also using—
Well, so the whole— the whole thing— So I went to see Mark Benioff about what we were doing, and I showed him this whole thing where we're grabbing all this data, continuously monitoring us.
He says, I have a cloud.
Well, it's interesting. They've built this health cloud solution. And he said, look, we can power this whole part of what you're doing where all of our data plus your health record, it's all HIPAA compliant. Doctors can get in there and manage the patients, message them. So we were building that, and we saw what Health Cloud had done. We said, great, let's use that to power our platform. And Health Cloud has become this like great tool for us where you have all the HIPAA compliance, so the data is like super protected. You have all of the electronic health record integrated. You have all of our lifestyle context. So doctors in our system can look at all of this information and make determinations,
so
and they take care of you.
You're doing a service now.
The service, and the service
is
part automated.
What is it? How are you going to make
There's going to be a monthly subscription fee that ranges up
monitors
for,
your health, and then
that's
say
remote
insurance
monitoring.
Companies would like.
Yeah, and so look, in our clinical trials—
This is what other people— this
One third of the people that went through our clinical trials in the U.S. found a disease, a major one, that they didn't know they had before. It was shocking to us. In our international trials, we had crazy results, like— 60% of the people nearly that went through it didn't know that they had high blood pressure. 30% didn't know they had full-blown diabetes. I mean, crazy stuff. And so you catch it early. We had built out a whole, you know, kind of proprietary automated behavior change system in the original.
Before, which suggested suggestions.
Smart Coach, yeah. Well, it's suggestions that moved your behavior.
Right.
And we scrubbed that with—
You should sleep 8 hours, this and that.
Well, it was way beyond that. It was sort of personalized, and it was like tools to coach you and
I remember
and
it was
do
irritating.
That.
But go ahead.
Look, it worked at scale. Over 13 million users, the results were staggering.
No, I get it. I agree.
And so combining that—
I don't even like when Apple Watch tells me to get up, but I don't— that's why I don't—
Well, you don't like people telling you to
do
stuff.
No, that's true. That's a fair point.
It's another entrepreneurial trait, Kara. No, so look, you combine all that machine automation with this early detection, and like the results have been staggering in terms of what we've been able to catch people. And the whole notion is catch it early when you can treat it. It saves a bunch of money for your company, for your insurance, for your government.
Let me say again.
Whatever.
Great early idea, but lots of people are in this space.
There's nobody who's doing the entire service stack.
Okay.
There's different people who've done—
There's a lot of people going to get
Apple's doing great devices. We're going to integrate with those devices. There's people— And I can explain to
you. There's Color, there's all kinds. There's
Color is a partner.
Yeah, okay.
Right? So we integrate the genetic data. There's different people who've tried to do AI, but when you have the continuous raw information that lets you build better models, some people are doing the human component, but not the human component combined with the automated component. So it's the entire stack.
Right.
And what's cool is that Health Cloud allows us to pull it all together and allows doctors and healthcare professionals make smarter decisions.
So you've pulled out the choice bit from all these different devices, like the choice bit, which is this service, correct? Because that was part of your up device.
The service, so on the up device, we had an application that we ran that did all this stuff automated.
Right.
So we've built the new one off of the foundations that we learned from that, but we've added in all this human doctors, and this whole new service that we built is completely new from scratch.
What's it called?
For now, the company's called Job One Health. We haven't announced the name of the service
yet. And
then
this software could be available on your device or other people's. It can be – it's a system.
It's a system. So we will use other wearables. The reason we made our own wearables is so that we had really accurate data.
Right, I got that. I got that.
Right.
So let's finish up talking about – so it's debuting this week, and then you will roll it out to people in variety of ways.
Correct. We've already started to roll that out, sort of in form of clinical trials.
Individuals can buy it, or companies will do it, or insurance companies will recommend it.
All the above.
And there's a lot of these, like I said.
All the above.
What is your worry right now? You've certainly raised significantly less money, so that's not – you don't have to deal with a device or people sweating on it or
– Yeah, no. And
the Chinese coming in and copying it.
I worry about, you know, people, execution, you know, making sure it's tight. All the ingredients that we have for this service have been proven now. It's very different from – you know, you build a device, you put it on a package, right, on a boat, put it on a shelf, hold your breath. Is it going to sell? Like, now we're rolling it out 100 users at a time. We make sure it works. Are we achieving it? And then we get the next set, and then the next set. So it's a different kind of scalar model. It's slower, but it's a lot more foundationally sound. So we're really excited because now we've gotten to a point where it's clinically validated. We have third-party results. We're publishing all that data. It's a different sort of channel structure. It's a subscription model. And we're just taking our time to sort of tune it, get it right.
All right. Well, I have two more questions. And there, one's a positive, one's a negative one. I'm just going to tell you in advance. Let me do – which one do you want first?
Whatever you want.
Okay, I'll
do negative. Let's go negative and then positive.
You have raised all this money. We referred to it before.
I haven't raised all this money
in
the new thing.
You did before, previously. Yeah. Why do you get a chance again? Like, if a woman did this, I'm guessing would never get funded again, like that kind of thing.
Well,
why?
I hope that's not true.
Well, it is.
I think everybody should get a second
of
chance.
Course.
I don't care if you're black, white, Muslim,
right,
Jewish,
but most people don't.
Female.
It seems like guys get bigger ascension. Why do you get this more than second chance? Why do you think
know.
You get it?
Look, to be totally candid, yeah, it hasn't been easy.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that it's hard to get a second chance. I mean, we were fortunate. We created a lot of things that no one had ever done before.
Right.
And now they're sort of leading what mm-hmm. I mean, think about what's
yeah,
hot right now.
Yeah,
it's
but
all stuff
everybody
that
else
we
is
were
benefiting. Right, yeah. But
everybody else
does,
is benefiting.
How does that
right?
feel, for one? And then secondly, why do you
I'm
get
proud.
This?
Look, I'm so proud of what we did, and I'm proud that other people stood on our shoulders. And, like, these ultimately, like, I feel like a little bit of the godfather of a bunch of these different things.
Right.
Now, I think
sitting
what we're
on your
doing,
shoulders is one thing, but squashing you down and you don't get the benefit of it is...
Well, look, it's a journey, and the story's not done
so
yet.
So why do you get a second chance?
This is the
chance.
Next chapter.
Why do you deserve a second chance?
Well, look, number one, I actually think when you go through these things, it makes you 1,000,000% smarter, right? It makes you 1,000,000% more humble, and it makes you 1,000,000% more thoughtful. And so, frankly, I think we're better tooled now, given all of the fire that we had to walk through. It was not easy, Kara. A lot of people were just like, walk away, go do something else. Like, it would have been a lot easier, right?
And also,
but we stuck
Hussein,
with it.
You're an asshole. How dare you? You know what I mean? Like,
totally.
That, right.
And you know me. I mean,
right. I'm using you as a proxy for all of Silicon Valley. I'm sorry to do that. But sometimes it's like, why should we give
I can
of
handle
you?
It.
Okay.
I can handle
why
it.
We, why
I'm
should we give
it.
All you people a second chance? Why? You know what I mean? You've broken a lot of stuff. Like, I'm not giving you the Facebook responsibility. You didn't break democracy. But why should we give Silicon
that's
Valley?
That's a hard
right
burden
now,
to
there's
carry.
A tech clash. Why should we give you all a second chance? There's this new thing that Julie Ang was doing, the markup to, you know, like there's a lot of like, what the hell?
So, look, I think everybody deserves an opportunity to kind of continue.
Support for this show comes from Fundrise. Buy low, sell high. It's easy to say, hard to do. For example, high interest rates are crushing the real estate market right now. Demand is dropping and prices are falling, even for many of the best assets. It's no wonder the Fundrise Flagship Fund plans to go on a buying spree, expanding its billion-dollar real estate portfolio over the next few months. You can add the Fundrise Flagship Fund to your portfolio in just minutes, and with as little as $10 by visiting fundrise.com/fox. Carefully consider the investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses of the Fundrise Flagship Fund before investing. This and other information can be found in the fund's prospectus at fundrise.com/flagship. This is a paid advertisement.
More to-dos, less time, and an infinite number of tools to keep track of. Sometimes doing business has never felt harder, but you don't need a miracle to hit your goals. You can just use HubSpot, because their all-in-one customer platform can make growing your business infinitely easier. Imagine this: high-quality leads, fast closing deals, wildly happy customers, and more benchmark-breaking quarters. It's not a miracle, it's HubSpot. Visit HubSpot.com to get started today.